Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. I certainly hope you enjoyed last week's special episode featuring John Guy and Julia Fox talking about their amazing new book about Anne Boleyn. I wanted to launch that on the anniversary of the date that Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn left for France, the end of 1532, sort of embarking on that very international, as we learn from Julia and John, experience of Anne's as Queen of England. So we had that special, and now we're back to our regular schedule. I have been traveling quite a bit, as many of you know, and so I thought what I wanted to do this time is share some of my travels. If you're watching on YouTube, you'll get a little clue straight away because I have the Smithsonian Journeys placard with me today. I am talking about one of the Smithsonian Journeys I was able to take to the Lake District. It was absolutely wonderful. We went some beautiful places. I met some wonderful people. And you know, I'm a huge fan of Smithsonian and Smithsonian Journeys, so a big shout out to them. But I wanted to share with you some of the research I did, some of the things we saw. We didn't even see everything there is to see in that area, but I thought it would be fun to look at some of them. So we are going to spend some time imaginatively in the Lake District, exploring some of the kings, queens, and castles in Cumbria. And I'll just say, I do have a lot of visuals for this. So if you're listening to a podcast and you're not able to see them, you might want to just shift over to YouTube just this time and see some of the amazing images. So just making that invitation. First of all, I want to share Pendragon Castle, which is associated with the legend of King Arthur. Now, it's thought to have been built by Uther Pendragon, King Arthur's father. And there's a funny little rhyme. It's along the River Eden, which you will see in the Lake District or in Cumbria. And apparently, Uther wanted to divert the river to build the castle in a particularly special place, but was unable to do so. And the part of the little rhyme, "Let Uther Pendragon do what he can, Eden will run where Eden has ran." So in other words, he was unable, despite being Uther Pendragon, to divert the Eden River, but the castle remains. There are, of course, other Arthurian sites, but this is kind of a special one. Now, here is King Arthur, one of the nine worthies in this image. Of course, there's no evidence really of King Arthur being a real person. The legend might have been based on a great warrior, maybe not a king, but the legend of King Arthur certainly informs a lot of the history of Britain, including Wales and England. And it really is a fun place to sort of explore. And because so much of the Lake District is still undeveloped, you can really get a sense of some of those magical, possibly mystical times. Now, a later owner of the area is Lady Anne Clifford. So we don't really know exactly when the first building on that spot was. We do know that one of the early owners was Hugh de Morville, who was one of the knights who killed Thomas Becket. So it had sort of an interesting past. But Lady Anne Clifford rebuilt the castle in 1660. And she's very interesting. She inherited her father's title, very unusual in the 17th century, and became Baroness Clifford in her own right. So she was a patron of literature and eventually held the office of High Sheriff of Westmoreland. And Queen Anne, the wife of James VI of Scotland and James I of England, encouraged Lady Anne Clifford to hold this in her own right and pursue and keep her claim to her title. And Lady Anne was married twice. Her marriages perhaps weren't entirely successful. According to the ideas of the time, she was described as having an unyielding personality and blamed for the failure of her marriages. In any case, she outlived most of her relatives and died at age 86, which was very unusual in 1676. So she was a really important owner of that castle. Great history. Now, we also have Dalton Castle, which is associated with King Stephen. You can see this is an early stronghold. It just has that sense of a stronghold. And the legend is that the nearby and very powerful Furness Abbey, the abbot there decided to build this stronghold to protect against the Scots, or the Picts, as they were sometimes known. And then King Stephen, King, granted the charter of the lordship to the abbey in 1127. But what is the deal with Stephen? And of course, the question is, was Stephen the rightful king, or did the title of monarch really belong to the Empress Matilda? You'll remember that Henry I's son, William, died. He perished in the sinking of the White Ship. Sometimes that's known as the White Ship disaster in 1120. And in fact, the ship was just going back and forth sort of between England and France at the time. There was a lot of back and forth. And when the ship that is said to have become sort of a party ship celebrating the great victories, when that happened, apparently the captain had also partied a little too much and it ran aground. And as it was sinking, William the heir was loaded into a lifeboat, but he heard others crying out for help, including one of his half-sisters. Henry I had two legitimate children and a host of illegitimate children. And William insisted they go back and rescue her. And in doing so, he perished, she perished, most of the people perished. So Henry was left with only Matilda, his daughter, as his legitimate heir. And in 1126, he convinced the barons and his lords to swear fealty to her and uphold her claim to the throne. She married in 1128, she married Geoffrey of Anjou and headed over there and was there when Henry I died in 1135. That's when Stephen jumps in and claims the throne, and thus comes the anarchy, the battle between Empress Matilda, who also claimed the throne, and they battled over the throne for many years. Eventually, it was agreed. Matilda sort of gave up her right to her son, Henry, and it was agreed that Stephen would reign until he died, and then Henry would take the throne. But it was a bit of a controversy. So the abbey was dissolved in the dissolution of the monasteries under Henry VIII, and the castle was used as a courthouse. It became sort of a public building, and eventually it was owned by the family and the Duke of Buccleuch and given to the National Trust to preserve by John Douglas Montagu Scott. And so we have that castle and its preservation largely due to him. So kudos to him. Another castle, and one of my favorites that we visited, is Muncaster Castle. This is a very famous castle in Cumbria that was owned by the Pennington family, the Pennetone, later became the Pennington family. We know that there was a fortification built in the 1300s to fight against the Scots again in Northern England, lots of battles with the Scots, and in particular, Robert Bruce. Now, some of the stones used to build this castle came from a Roman fort. Of course, Hadrian's Wall was built across England, and there were forts all along the wall to keep England safe. And so as those forts fell into disrepair, a lot of the stones were reused, and that happened here. Now, during the Wars of the Roses, this is just an idea of this castle standing out in a time where there was nothing else around it, sort of a romantic version of it. But you can see that as a stronghold and as a place of refuge, it did stand out, and that was true during the Wars of the Roses. Now, it's said that according to tradition, the Penningtons invited in Henry VI, who was battling for his throne. His troops were at least, Henry VI was on the run, and he was invited into this stronghold by the Penningtons. And in response, he gave Sir John a Venetian glass bowl and said that as long as this bowl remains unriven, the Penningtons from Muncaster will never be driven. That's the legend. But I want to show you next to the picture or the image, the portrait of Henry is a picture I took. Now, that is not actually the bowl right there. That is a photo. So it's a photo of a photo of the bowl. It's called the Luck of Muncaster. Apparently, it still is kept within the walls of the castle, but even the guides don't know exactly where it is. So that legend continues, and it's sort of irresistible. Now, of course, I couldn't resist a little shout out to King Lear, because there is also in the castle a portrait of Thomas Skelton, the final fool of the Penningtons to live in the castle. And his nickname became Tom Fool. The phrase or the word tomfoolery is thought to come from him. And he may well have been the model for King Lear's fool in Shakespeare's play, King Lear. That fool who speaks truth to power very much may have been modeled on Tom Fool, who is said to still hold great power in Muncaster Castle. So if you ever visit, you are strongly encouraged to greet and say goodbye to Tom and to treat him and his legend with the utmost respect. Now we'll go over to Carlisle Castle, again on the border with Scotland. It was heavily fortified for many, many years, and you can see looking at it, it certainly looks like one of the castles built largely for fortification. Some are more fortresses than residences, but this was a very important garrison. Again, it was one of the ones that supported Hadrian's Wall. So there has been a stronghold on this location for hundreds of years. And in 1092, William II enlarged and fortified it even further, and Henry I did as well. So this was a well-fortified and very important stronghold. And interestingly, not these, but when the English were in control, it went back and forth. The Scots would capture it and the English got it back. And it's thought that during the 14th and 15th century, again, the Wars of the Roses, that the Lancastrians used heavy artillery, as this represents. And this is one of the first records we have of heavy artillery being used, was during the Wars of the Roses from this castle. Now, there's more, because one of the most famous prisoners held here was Mary, Queen of Scots. She spent several months here at Carlisle in the Warden's Tower, which is then often called Mary's Tower, sort of in her honor. And so this castle has associations with Elizabeth. You'll see that she was here in 1577, long after Mary had left, but Mary was held here as well. Strongly fortified, important place. And here is Carlisle Castle, and you can imagine it continued to be important during the English Civil War. So the castle itself was held by the royalists, who were supporting the royal family, fighting against the forces of the parliamentarians. And the Jacobites, when that war was lost, the Jacobites wanted to and captured this as well, fighting for their claim to the throne, which came through the Stuarts. Of course, Charles I having been executed, and then the Hanoverians having been invited in, the Jacobites continued to fight for their claim, and Carlisle Castle was important to them. And so the Jacobite theme is still strong there in Carlisle. Okay, here we have Egremont Castle, And this was important. It was originally built in the 12th century and maybe even earlier. It was built again out of some of that Roman stonework. It was built with Roman stones. And the Scots, again, many battles with the Scots, they took control. And under King David of Scotland, it was a Scots stronghold. However, battles continued, and it was then held by the De Lucy family and held for England and eventually sacked by Robert Bruce again. So in the 14th century, it changed hands once again. Now, it continued to be important, and in 1569, during one of the first really strong and potentially successful, it was put down, but it was a really significant rebellion against Elizabeth I from the rebels in the north, the nobles in the north. Mary, Queen of Scots, had arrived in England in 1568, and by 1569, there were rebellions to put her on the throne instead of Elizabeth, and the castle was held. It was captured by the royal forces after defeating the Northern Rebellion, and was abandoned in the 1570s and was sort of allowed to fall into disrepair as we see it now. A single room remained into the 18th century, and it was a courthouse for a while. And in fact, Wordsworth wrote a poem, The Horn of Egremont Castle, and that poem is about how the true leader of the castle, the true inheritor, only the rightful heir can blow the horn and get it to sound. And there's a wonderful story in that poem where he talks about how the horn is attempted to be blown by the wrong person and it doesn't work. And then everyone thought the rightful heir had been killed, but he comes back and they hear the horn blow. It's very exciting. But that also is associated with that castle. So let's continue moving on to Kendal Castle, which has an association with the Parr family. So this original stronghold, again, was built very early in sometime between 1206 and 1215. The Sheriff of Lancaster, whose name was Gilbert Fitzroger Renfield, built that again as a stronghold. And later he rebelled against King John, and King John seized the castle. So it was built as a stronghold and then used against the royals, and then the royals seized the castle. Later, however, the family came back into favor, and in 1241, it was restored to the original family. However, later in the 13th century, it passed to the Parr family, and Elizabeth and Henry the Fourth, Edward the Third and Henry the Fourth, no Elizabeths yet, Edward the Third and Henry the Fourth both really valued the Parr family. This was a strong family, very supportive of the royals, not like the earlier owner of the castle who had rebelled. And William Parr in particular was highly valued by Henry the Fourth. And so the castle became a favorite and a symbol of his high standing with the king. And then the castle goes through a number of members of the Parr family, John Parr, and then his son Thomas, and Thomas's grandson, whose son was another William Parr. This William Parr might look a little more familiar. He was a key player in the Tudor court. And in fact, you know that because this is a sketch by Hans Holbein the Younger. Not just anyone could be sketched by Hans Holbein. So you know this is someone who was a key player, as was his sister, Catherine Parr, who married Henry VIII in 1543. So that castle was in the family of a rebel, of supporters, and then passed down to someone who was the brother of the queen consort. And of course, after Henry's death, by that time, the Parr family was no longer at Kendal Castle. It was actually bought by the town and used for the Diamond Jubilee of Queen Victoria, used as a spot to celebrate because it had been purchased by the town and was now a municipal building. But it has a wonderful and very royal history. Now, here we have another castle, Ray Castle. This was not built as a defense against the Scots, as many have been, but almost as a defense against the weather, because the original owner was a surgeon, James Dawson, who built this castle. He came to the Lake District, and in 1840, he built a castle that was supposed to look like an ancient fortification, but it was in fact built in 1840. And he and his nephew and other family members, this was really built sort of as a celebration of the family. Now, the family included a cousin who was Hardwick Ronsley, who was the vicar of Ray Church. So Ray Castle and Ray Church were very much working together during this period of time in the late years of the 19th century. And in fact, Hardwick Ronsley is one of the founders of the National Trust. Ray Castle gave the family an opportunity to look over the lands, and they knew of the buildings in the Lake District. And of course, during this time, during the end of the 19th century, the end of Victoria's reign, there was a lot of industrial work going on, the Industrial Revolution, a lot of development. And these folks were resistant to what they considered the overdevelopment, and they wanted to preserve land and buildings that had this rich history throughout this area. And the Lake District was very important to them. And so they worked to preserve the property, to resist the making it available for developers to put giant hotels and car parks and all these kinds of things. And there was a vision of that that went into the National Trust. And one very important resident of the Lake District and Cumbria, who was very active in this effort and very fond of Ray Castle, is Beatrix Potter of Peter Rabbit fame. In fact, as a child, she stayed at Ray Castle and just was enchanted by it, even though it was sort of a made-up castle. It wasn't really from early days, but she was determined that that and other important historic buildings be preserved. And she became friends with Hardwick Ronsley, and he encouraged her. They had quite a strong and helpful relationship. And in fact, she would help him purchase land, some of the lands that the National Trust couldn't quite afford to buy yet. She would purchase and hold for them and then sell to them when they had raised the money. So she was also, although not officially one of the founders of the National Trust, very important to the trust and donated a lot of her land. She bought up a lot of lands, preserved the Hertford sheep. She did a lot of great things. So not just Peter Rabbit, she did a lot more. In fact, that is me at Ray Castle. We did visit in 2011. It has quite a recent history. In 2011, the trust proposed maybe having Ray Castle as a hotel. And so it was designed for that, but they realized that it could serve more visitors, attract more visitors, be available to more people as a site. So in 2014, the trust applied for permission for it to become used and open to visitors and active as a historic site, which of course it is now, as I'm showing by standing in front of it. So these are just some of the castles having served kings and queens in Cumbria. I hope you have enjoyed joining me for a little journey into the Lake District to see some of the wonderful history there. If you do get a chance to go, I encourage you to do so. and to appreciate the work that has gone into restoring and preserving these important sites there. That history goes all the way back, even before the Romans, but it's wonderful to see Hadrian's Wall and just imagine everything that's happened as the people have walked there. And of course, that shows us that history really does show us what's possible. So thank you for joining me. I hope you continue to do so and come back as we keep shaking up history together. Thank you.